Hey, welcome to this episode of Light 'Em Up. We take a deep dive on the criminal justice system, crime scene investigation, and leadership. We enlighten, educate, and empower others with the truth. Like it or not, the truth disturbs, the truth divides, but ultimately, the truth delivers. Hey, I'm your host, Phil Rizzo. I'm the principal owner of Rizzo's Protective Group. We are a high-risk security consulting firm headquartered out of Akron, Ohio, and with offices in the Bronx, New York, and Cerro Alto, the Dominican Republic. Hey, as we put the ball on the tee to line things up for kickoff, we speak life, health, and prosperity over each and every one of you, and we want to thank you for joining us tonight on this intensely focused, explosive, and investigative edition of Light 'Em Up. We travel back into the Deep South, again, to the Magnolia State, where the people's kindness is referred to as Southern hospitality. Those in the Magnolia State simply call it home. The municipality that our special guest serves is a thriving, bustling, growing community. As the community continues to grow, so does its reputation as a great place to live. Our listener response was overwhelming. You downloaded the first episode at a record pace rate through the first week of it being uploaded and live. You've asked for more, so we're here to provide you with exactly what you want. Our conversation ruffled some feathers. It seems as though some in law enforcement didn't want to hear anything but what they deemed to be their version of the facts. We've been looking forward to this conversation and are extremely fortunate to be sitting down together again with the assistant chief of police. Again, on the agreement of his anonymity, he's agreed to give us another unedited, behind-the-scenes, front-row version of the facts as he sees it from his professional experience and perspective. Our special guest has paid his dues. He's a high-ranking police administrator, a law enforcement leader who embraces a problem-solving mindset through systems and standards. He prides his work on provable methods, and he can respond to hard questions with straight answers. Our special guest enjoys digging to the bottom of questions and creating content relating to social issues, leadership topics, legal matters, and much, much more. Throughout his long, decorated, and dedicated career, he's worked in the Office of Professional Standards for another department in the Magnolia State. He earned his Master of Criminal Justice in 2013, Master of Public Administration in 2018, and he has successfully completed the FBI National Academy at Quantico, Virginia. Throughout his lifelong dedication to learning and his love of knowledge, he earned a graduate certificate in criminal justice education in 2022 and a certificate in strategy education for public leadership from an Ivy League school online in 2023. He's a basic instructor for law enforcement officer standards and training, and he's a police academy instructor on search and seizure, use of force, juvenile procedure, human trafficking, interview, and interrogation. And when he's not fighting crime and keeping the community safe for all who call it home, he has served as an adjunct instructor. Tonight we'll take another bite of the apple to drill down on the facts and findings of the extensive analytical research that he conducted on the extraordinary amount of discretion police officers have in how they go about using their police powers. Discretion in and of itself is not a bad thing, but the misuse of it has caused society to take a dim view of police who abuse their powers. It's imperative that measures are taken to establish clear and precise guidelines to govern the use of force by police. Discretion can be defined as the power to make a choice. It has been said that police need discretion to maintain order in society. Discretion is that characteristic which allows police to balance the dynamic tension between civility and liberty in a democratic, small d, society. And we're going to press deep into this white paper, which he authored, which again is entitled Seeing Color in Police Discretion. All this y mucho, mucho más aquí y solamente aquí on Light 'Em Up. Hey, Assistant Chief, it is such an honor to have you back with us on the witness stand. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Light 'Em Up.
Hey, Phil, I appreciate you having me back for another episode.
Oh, it's our pleasure, for sure. Absolutely. We're glad to have you. How are you? Let's start there. You doing well, we hope?
Yes, sir. I'm doing good. Doing real good.
That's great. That's great to hear. Let's focus our sights, lock and load, and get started straight out of the gate. Your in-depth white paper, entitled Seeing Color in Police Discretion, provided objective and independent knowledge on a very complex issue of the amount of discretion and how that discretion is used in carrying out an officer's official duties. I fundamentally believe that scientific evidence plays a critical role in promoting an equitable justice system and in improving public safety for all Americans. I found your research to be rigorous and insightful. As we focus on your important research that looks at one of the most important tools available to law enforcement officers, that being discretion, in this critical time when race, crime, and violence intersect in the overall administration of justice, bring us to and define for us what your hypothesis was that your study sought to prove or disprove.
Sure. So this was some research that I volunteered to do for a police department. It's located in my area of the state. And I was drawn towards this type of research because throughout my career in law enforcement, I've always wondered about racial disparities. And as far as hypotheses go, I suspected there probably were disparities that would be found once we started digging in to the enforcement data of this police department or likely any police department, as also based on different research studies that I've read from different areas of the country. They all tend to have similar findings. But what really made me passionate about wanting to find out for myself was just kind of reflecting on my own experiences, even as early as being a patrolman, and kind of thinking about, you know, what the traffic stops and encounters look like just on a regular shift. You always work night shift. And it was a very proactive environment. And I reflected on the training that we were given and the way the officers applied the training and the way that police officers and police administrators react to claims of selective enforcement, racial profiling, things of that nature. And what I knew from the beginning was all of those are looked at and thought about the same way, which is there's a common flaw that is always looked at by the police on an individual encounter level. Which, in other words, if there was a complaint or if there was a challenge about, you know, the racial relevance of an officer's decision in making a particular stop, the question was always this individual stop legal? And as long as that stop was legal, then it never really got looked at further and they never really zoomed out to see, well, what do all the stops look like when we put them together? And where I saw that come into place in training is especially there's a court case called Wren versus United States. And that's one of the case law holdings that officers hold to tightly, and they take a lot of comfort in using what Wren provided, which what that opinion provided for law enforcement was that it held that any stop, as long as it's based on a valid law or justification, is a legal stop, even if the reason given for the stop is not the true motivation for the stop. So in other words, that's getting us to the legality of pretextual stops. And just to give you an example for everyone in the audience of what exactly I mean by that, let's say I'm monitoring traffic and I see a car pass me and I just think to myself, the guys in that car, they look like they're up to no good. I just don't have a good feeling about these guys. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's not particularized suspicion, articulable reasonable suspicion of any criminal activity. That's what Terry v. Ohio would refer to as an unarticulable hunch. So I can't use that reason to stop them because that's not legal. However, if that same car is traveling 1 mile per hour over the speed limit, I now have a valid, objective, lawful reason to stop that car and investigate further. So I would stop them and say, hey, I'm stopping you for your speed. You're going 41 miles per hour in a 40 mile per hour zone. Even though that's the reason I point to, that's not the real reason for the stop. Wren said, on Fourth Amendment terms, that is a legal traffic stop. Now, Wren did acknowledge the part that people don't talk about very much, that racial profiling is not pursued under the Fourth Amendment, it's pursued under the 14th Amendment, which is a different legal framework and has to look at different factors. And typically, you need more than one traffic stop to determine if that's what's happening, if there's not any direct evidence of such. And what I found interesting about the Wren opinion is that in concept, it conflicts with what the court had earlier said in Delaware v. Prowse, which is unlimited discretion is one of the evils that the Constitution seeks to prohibit as far as officers being able to stop anyone for any reason. Wren spoke to that, saying that with the expansive traffic code, officers could just about stop any car for any reason. And they acknowledge that, and they still proceed with the conclusion that pretextual stops are okay as long as it's based on the valid Fourth Amendment reason. So long story short, I've seen that used day in and day out in law enforcement. And one day I got to wondering, what do all the stops look like together, which was brought to my attention. I stopped a car one night, and I don't remember what exactly led my attention to this car, but I made a traffic stop. I spoke with the driver. The driver was a younger black male, and I remember he had a very positive and very good demeanor as we spoke. We had a positive interaction, and I cut him loose with a warning and went about my business. And then the next night, I hear one of my zone partners call out a traffic stop, and I went to that scene to assist for officer safety reasons. We always do two officers to a stop routinely. So when I arrived, I found that same driver again stopped. And I approached him because the other officer who initiated the stop was now searching his car. And I just kind of got in some casual conversation with the driver because we recognized each other from the previous night. And I just said, man, how many times have you been pulled over? He was probably in his young 20s. And he goes, man, I kind of smiled and looked up in there and thought. He goes, probably about 30 times. And that's the first time I'd really kind of thought about, like, what is the cumulative effect of all these pretextual traffic stops, and what is the real thought process an officer has when they choose these pretextual traffic stops? Because as we've discussed, it's not based on the traffic violation that they're pointing to. That's not the real reason. So that leads to some really interesting questions. Well, what are the real reasons, and do we even know what those real reasons are? You know, it's completely plausible the officer has never articulated to themselves what they think gives them a gut feeling about whether or not they should make a traffic stop and investigate. So that's kind of getting into the existence of unconscious bias and things that drive our decisions and patterns and repetitions. So that was kind of the backstory, what led me to the research and also my hypothesis that there would probably be disparities present in the data.
I see. Very interesting indeed. What was the target audience for your in-depth study?
So the target audience is primarily for law enforcement because they're the ones that hold the key in making the decision that we are going to change what our impact on society is. So primarily it's for law enforcement. For law enforcement leaders to make a decision to implement some type of internal control where they're watching this data and keeping their finger on the pulse of it and making decisions based on what the data tells them and asking questions. But it's also for the line level officers, as we'll get into here shortly, is just being aware. You're asking yourself those questions when you say, ooh, I should go stop that car so I don't have a good feeling about them. Why not pause for a moment and make yourself articulate to yourself, what is it about this car that gives me this feeling? And I challenge you, if you can't come up with an articulable race-neutral reason that you don't make the traffic stop, not only would that violate the Constitution, but you know, furthermore, it's just good ethics for us. And it goes back to what type of society do we want to live in? Because this type of behavior, it has an impact on society over a long period of time. I've also pitched this topic to be presented at risk management conferences for a broader audience beyond just law enforcement, but more kind of getting into, you know, just the entire category of risk. But what I'm really not, I guess who I'm really not talking to with this research specifically is data scientists. They would be, their input is certainly helpful, but this is more of a disclaimer on my part that I'm not a data scientist. I'm not a professional researcher. I'm a law enforcement professional who's seen this stuff day in and day out, and I just took some basic techniques looking at the numbers and drawing conclusions from it. So I say that if there are data scientists, professional researchers listening, you know, I ask for a little bit of leeway if I misuse some terminology here and there, and for that reason, I've tried to back off of like the research-specific terminology and just kind of speak in more general terms, because that's what this is all about. It's about common sense conclusions from what we see when we look at disparities in numbers and not getting caught in the weeds about the specific research techniques and terminologies.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Now, you won't get any trouble from us. Now, if the data crunchers, if the number crunchers want to take an issue, well, they definitely have the green light to do so. But I'm sure between you and me, we'll be able to hit those out of the park without any trouble whatsoever. In keeping with the line of questioning about the research, share with our listeners what the specific treatment was that this research study consisted of.
So this research is trying to get essentially into the hearts and minds of officers, because we're digging deep into the subconscious of their brains, trying to figure out what it is that makes them use their discretion in the way that they use it. So the switch that we flip in this research, where we make a change in the research environment to look for different behavior, that occurs when we approach the officers halfway through the experiment and we show them their data broken down, you know, by race. for arrest and different types of traffic tickets. We show them this data, and we just simply let them observe whether or not there are disparities in their own data compared to the baseline that we use for comparison, but also a comparison to the department itself, because their printout that they get includes the departmental average, so they can very clearly see if they are higher than the department average, which kind of makes it hard for them to dispute, you know, the research itself. It's like, well, you know, just compared to your own peers, you have racial disparities at a much greater rate. So awareness, long story short, awareness is the switch that we try to flip to see if that drives different behaviors once they see their own data.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It really does. As we press forward, can you share with us what your research methodology was?
So the way that we went about this research is there were several steps. So just to kind of walk you through what it looked like is we looked at arrests and then also traffic citations separately. And then even within each of those, we go into different subcategories. But I'll use the arrests as an example to kind of walk you through a sample here. Took all of the arrests in the department. And then if you can just kind of visualize with me, it looks like, we'll say, a pile of data. I took that great big pile of arrests, and then I sorted them into two smaller piles. And those two smaller piles consisted of one being reactive arrest and the other being proactive arrest. So just to give you some definitions of what means what here, in the general sense, the reactive arrests were assigned the category if the arrest, or rather if the situation was initiated by the officer only because they were sent somewhere for a complaint by a civilian. So if an officer was dispatched to a scene of a crime and a witness or a bystander or a victim, someone reported to the officer, hey, this crime occurred and there is the suspect. The suspect is blank person. They point to them, or they give them enough identifying information to specifically identify the arrestee. The reason that's relevant to us is because the officers are not using their discretion in those arrests in terms of selecting who their arrestee will be. So in other words, if the officer shows up to the scene of a theft and the victim witnessed it and said, my purse was stolen by a white male and this is what he looked like, the officer does not have discretion to go find a black male to arrest instead. So we want to get a look at what arrests look like when the officer is not able to use their discretion. So we have that pile of data. And then in the other pile, we have the proactive category of arrest, which these are basically the opposite. They're situations where the officer had full discretion to choose who they were going to engage with in a situation that ultimately leads to an arrest. So your classic example there is an officer parked in the median, observing traffic, making traffic stops or traffic violations, and then say the circumstances, for example, lead to a search of a car and the driver is arrested. That would be a proactively initiated encounter. The key difference in those two situations is the officer's discretion in choosing who they're going to engage with. So that's why those two different labels are relevant and valuable to us. So once I have those two piles, I then go back to each individual pile. So I go back to the reactive pile of arrest, and I sort those out by white arrestees and by black arrestees. And that tells us what the racial demographics of the reactive category of arrest are. And I do the same thing for the proactive arrest. And what we're looking for here is if we're trying to measure how the officers use their discretion and what the racial impact is of the use of their discretion, then I want to compare and look for disparities in with discretion and without discretion. And the theory is that if the officers are using race-neutral factors to select the target of their investigation in both situations, then the demographics of each category should be relatively similar.
I see.
If there's a disparity, then the only difference is, under this theory, the only difference is the use of discretion. So that's how it's laid out. The way that we applied the treatment was we took 90 days of data without telling the officers anything. We then presented them with their data at the 90-day mark and said, this is what your data looks like. And we let them observe the differences compared to the baseline that we used in the reactive arrest, as well as comparing themselves to their own peers for the departmental average. And then we took another measurement 90 days after that. So the only difference between the first 90 days and the second 90 days, this officer is now aware of what their data looks like, and they're aware that this is now being measured. And the intent there is to create some thought process and bring attention to the subconscious portion of their brains that they may not be listening to loud enough or clearly enough when they engage in these proactive encounters.
I see. Okay. Makes perfect sense as well. Like I said, this study is very rigorous. What were some of your specific findings and your specific conclusions drawn from this rigorous study?
So as far as specific results in the arrest category, we had the proactive category of arrests, which initially were 74% consisted of black arrestees, 26% consisted of white arrestees. This is before the intervention. After the intervention was applied and the officers were made aware of their own data, the proactive arrest rate for black subjects decreased by 14%, which is a large enough percentage that is definitely greater than a coincidence and definitely impactful, reducing that down to 60%. What was interesting was during that same time frame, the reactive category of arrest that we were banking on this being our baseline, it changed only by 1%. That's even after the officers were aware of the study and were being more conscious of their actions. So what that tells me as a researcher is that I set this up correctly. In other words, that my assumption that the reactive category of arrest contained little to no discretion, the fact that the officers were aware of the study and that only changed less than 1% definitely supports that, while at the same time, proactive arrest decreased in the black arrestee category by 14%. So scientifically, that was a success, seeing one category change and the other not, as far as answering the question, do I have this research set up correctly? And speaking to the baseline we are using, just a little more information for your audience who's listening, probably realize that even the reactive baseline sounds like it's fairly unbalanced. So let me give you some context there and explain a little more about that. So the census data for the community that this is located in is roughly 60-40, 60% white, 40% black, just using round numbers to kind of give you a comparison to the reactive arrest rates here racially. But what's also important to recognize in this research, like any research, there's going to be limitations that the researcher has, and there's going to be unknowns and things that we're not able to measure. So in this research, one of our limitations and unknowns is the effect of bias by other people other than the police that occurs before the police ever get there. So using thefts and shoplifting just as one of unlimited examples, if an officer responds to the scene of the shoplifting and the store manager identifies the arrestee to the officer, yes, it's true in that situation the officer did not use any discretion. They simply responded to the information that was given to them. However, what's important to acknowledge is that there may be bias on the part of the store manager and who they observe in the store looking for shoplifting to occur. So if you only watch one category, it's no surprise that you're going to only detect crimes in one category. So we have to recognize that's just an uncontrollable factor, at least in this research, because the research here isn't on society as a whole. The research is rather on the use of discretion and the role of discretion by the police officer. So that's our starting point, is once the police become involved.
I see what you mean. Yeah, that makes sense. It does. It depends on what you're looking for as to what you're going to see. So yeah, I follow you 100%. You explained that very well for us. For our listeners, we want to mention early and often, and you'll hear this throughout the broadcast, to access more content from the Assistant Chief of Police, you can visit www.lobotomyofthelaw.com. And we'll mention that more throughout this episode, but we wanted to touch on that. If you want to access more content from the Assistant Chief, again, you can visit www.lobotomyofthelaw.com. As we tap the clutch and shift gears here, we want to keep the ball and the momentum rolling. Let's move forward with this. This comes to mind after listening to you. Given the fact that police officers are given such wide latitude and an extraordinary amount of discretion in how they use their official powers, why do you think officers often default primarily to lethal force as their first option and response with such regularity? And keeping in mind that the use of force continuum, it's not a linear process. It's not a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 straight line. But deadly force is listed as the last option. So my question and my thought processes go along this route.
So one thought, just as I kind of jump off the question here, I'm not so sure about the way the question's set up as far as like the words often, primarily, regularly. Yeah, I only say that because just from my own experience, anecdotal or not, I've worked alongside plenty of officers who have had their weapons drawn and could have legally justified pulling the trigger but chose not to. They chose to continue negotiating, whether it was through a conscious decision, whether it's hesitation or something else. I've just personally seen plentiful examples of where that type of restraint was used. Now, I don't think it's necessarily unfair that your question's posed that way based on the way the perception is, just because all of those incidents I spoke of, just they wouldn't be publicized. And why would they? It's just not newsworthy. So I think there's a lot more of those out there than what people realize, but there's definitely occurrences where officers do resort to lethal lethal force as a first option, and they do so quickly. And some reasons I think that would explain that is, I think if they pull the trigger, starting point, if they fire their weapon, I don't think it's hard to say that they were probably truly in fear of their lives, but fear is a subjective feeling. It's not a fact. So we then have to kind of get into the perception, which just kind of loops back to unconscious bias again, which is getting into why are we reacting the way that we are? Why do we perceive things the way that they are? So that's kind of where my mind goes in answering this, is if they're quickly resorting to deadly force and they say, I truly wasn't fear in my life. Well, could have their subjective feeling of fear been explainable by unconscious bias? This is, I'd say, more so relevant in cases where the officer immediately thinks a person is holding a weapon, but in reality, they're not. They're holding some other innocent object. Because that's heavily perception-based on the officer's part, where unconscious bias would have a much stronger impact, and probably less so in the cases where the suspect is indeed being combative, and the officer just makes a judgment call about, you know, what force option to use. I think those are much more fact-intensive than the first category that we mentioned. Other than that, just a note on force continuums, since that's referenced as part of the question. I'm not a fan of force continuums, and I never have taught the force continuum model, just for a few reasons. Instead, I prefer the Graham factors as a guide for force. And the reason I'm against the force continuum is, number one, like there's no standard use of force continuum. It's hard to find any two continuums that look alike. If you research agency policies from across the country, you'll find some of them are different, some of them conflict with each other, some of them are extremely complicated, whereas others are very simple. The Graham factors are the federal constitutional standard. That's what we're going to be judged against in court. So to me, it would make the most sense for us to train the way that we're going to be judged in that situation. And after all, it is the constitutional standard. But also, I've read where the Department of Justice no longer requires a use of force continuum in their consent decrees, nor does the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. They no longer teach force continuums. And I suppose one of the theoretical flaws with a continuum is it tries to put the Fourth Amendment into neat and clean legal categories with neat legal rules. And the Supreme Court told us in several cases that one of the things about the Fourth Amendment is that it cannot be reduced to a neat set of legal rules. It can't be precisely defined. It's not capable of mechanical application. And that's kind of exactly what a continuum tries to do. And sometimes it lacks context for different types of situations, being that it only focuses on the presence of resistance, and it focuses less so on the other two Graham factors, being the seriousness of the offense and the presence of immediate danger, three forms other than active resistance or fleeing. So in other words, I just believe the Graham factors have a lot more depth to them. And again, it's the federal constitutional standard. So yeah, what better resource to use than that?
Yeah, that's good to know. It really is. Use the Graham factors, and you don't need to use the force continuum, because it's true. You never find the force continuum to be listed the same. Absolutely. In your experience of the use of discretion, and you've mentioned some of the points that we're going to address with this question here previously, as you've been sharing with us, could you share with us how the high amount of officer discretion can lead to officers being more susceptible to the effects of unconscious bias in their thoughts and official actions?
So there's some really good research by the LAPD Office of Inspector General. Their research is far more in-depth than mine, and they're one of the studies that I've cited in developing mine. But one of their interesting takeaways was that there was definitely a relationship between activities where the officer had more discretion and the racial disparities that flowed from that. So in other words, amount of discretion and the amount of disparities, they go together. And that was a very, very robust look at it, because they were looking at things, everything from stops to arrest to types of searches, the different search warrant exceptions. Some of them are low discretion, some of them are high discretion. So they took a lot of different cross sections of that topic and got the same answer. So bias will work its way into discretion as you are faced with these choices. And if you're in a situation where you're allowed to make a choice in one direction or the other, you have to ask yourself, you know, what are the odds that if I have a unfavorable view of whoever I'm dealing with, am I going to select a more favorable choice on that side of the decision that I'm making? But, you know, it's not always as simple, because, you know, we're talking about unconscious decisions. decisions and unconscious effects. It's not as simple as saying, you know, I don't like this guy's skin color, so I'm going to punish him with a ticket, because that would actually be conscious bias. That would be just explicit bias, which is much easier to diagnose, but less common. But that's what makes unconscious bias so dangerous and so insidious, is that it's so hard to find, even within the person doing it. It's hard for them to really acknowledge and admit that it goes that deep, and that there's something in their subconscious that's pushing this encounter in one direction or the other. We see this scientifically in shoot and don't shoot studies involving civilians and police officers. These are the studies you've probably heard of where the participants are given a gun, like a totally simulated gun, and they're flashed a photo of white subjects and black subjects, and the difference is they're all holding different objects, whether it be a weapon or whether it be a cell phone or a wallet or something else. They have to make a decision whether or not they're going to shoot, and they consistently find racial disparities in that research. Where I also see the relationship between bias and discretion is situations where it may be reversed, in the sense that an officer approaches a car and the driver reacts negatively towards the officers because they suspect they were stopped for an unfair reason. And right off the bat, that creates a bad rapport between the officer and driver, which, ethically speaking, I don't believe that's a justifiable reason to make a decision on whether or not to give someone a citation. But I can tell you, just in my experience of working in law enforcement, it absolutely is going to be part of the outcome, if not more than part. But also, I've seen it in interdiction research, where the officers are posted up and they're looking specifically for drug traffickers or other types of traffickers. And again, this gets into the pretextual traffic stops. So they're looking for people who they believe fit a profile of committing a specific type of crime, and then they use traffic law as a completely unrelated reason to make the traffic stop and then investigate further.
To access more content from the Assistant Chief of Police, you can visit www.lobotomyofthelaw.com, and we'll mention that more throughout this episode, but we wanted to touch on that. If you want to access more content from the Assistant Chief, again, you can visit www.lobotomyofthelaw.com. Share with us what, in your vast experience and professional opinion, would be three concrete aspects of training that, to your knowledge, have had a positive impact or effect on reducing bias among officers in the use of discretion, as you've observed firsthand.
So I think some real actual things that law enforcement could do in this regard is, number one, they have to be willing to talk about unconscious bias in the first place. We can't fix these other things that stem from it if we don't talk about, what's causing it in the first place. So number one, talking about unconscious bias, proving its existence, whether it's through research, anecdotal examples, or whatever brings the concept to life and makes it easy to understand. Secondly, we have to acknowledge when we see disparities. We can't brush them off and ignore them. We have to acknowledge them. We have to then question why the disparity exists. We got to get to the bottom of that. And then lastly, there's got to be accountability for the officer's actions in this topic. A lot of officers are allowed to go their entire career and they never get asked about racial disparities in their enforcement. So when we find that, there has to be accountability and there has to be a plan to get to the bottom of it, and then lastly, correct it.
I see. Okay. That makes sense. Now, if we're talking about print media or television reporting, what, in your professional opinion, would be a journalistic report that is focused on, say, for example, a questionable or controversial initial contact between an officer and a civilian that involves a use of force, whether it's excessive or not? What should that report contain in order to be more justly, fairly, and accurately to address the fact that bias and unconscious bias is more so of a human problem and not solely a law enforcement problem?
Say, just, speaking in general, since I don't have a specific article to critique in front of me. But so, for one, like, if there's going to be an inference about race being a relevant factor about why this happened the way it happened, there needs to be something to back that up if that's where the article's going. Sometimes it's just a fact, just painting the picture. Other times there's a very strong insinuation that race is partially responsible for the outcome. So if it's going down that road, kind of like we talked about earlier, it's going to have to contain some evidence where it's showing more than one encounter to really show that this yes, this is a pattern. This is repetition. There's something more than this one encounter. And a lot of times, it just shows that one encounter. Now, to be fair, that's what the story's about, you know, if that one event is newsworthy. But I guess they have to decide, is the newsworthiness what happened in the interaction, or is there a bigger story about race being relevant? And if that's what your bigger story is, you know, sometimes it's lacking something more than just an inference in that regard. Other than that, there's, you know, as far as the human problem, law enforcement problem, there's definitely a strong focus in journalism on law enforcement compared to other professions where implicit bias exists. But again, that's also, I mean, that's a fair response, because after all, the purpose of the First Amendment is for government and police accountability, and it has a huge social impact. So you'd expect them to have a greater focus on those types of forced encounters that citizens have with their government that have serious outcomes. But the other side of that is, yes, this is a human problem, and by not either starting the story there or by the officers not having education in their own circles about the story starting there, there can be a reaction from the law enforcement profession where they get defensive about these stories, because sometimes there's a quick blurb of a headline that tries to capture a quick message, and it sounds different than necessarily what it means. So if the officers are picking up that, hey, there's an insinuation that I'm just a racist person because I was on this traffic stop and they're talking about this one interaction between me and this person, to them, they hear the narrative like, hey, I'm a racist. And they know, like, I'm not a racist. I don't think that way. But without zooming out and understanding that you cannot be racist and still have issues with implicit bias that gives disparate racial results. And by understanding that, it's a little easier to kind of bridge the gap between these individual encountering narratives and the stories that we ourselves are putting out that feed this media cycle, and kind of reaching some common ground on, you know, what is the actual problem to solve here.
I see.
You know, one way law enforcement can assist in that is publishing, you know, publishing their own news as far as showing what the aggregate data is, whether it's focused on race or not. You know, race is just one part of policing. It's a very important social aspect to make sure that we're, you know, compliant with the 14th Amendment. But your citizens are interested in your police department as a whole, as far as what are the crime patterns, you know, what is our police department giving us, what do we want from our police department, and of course, what if any disparities exist. The President's Report on 21st Century Policing recommends sharing that aggregate data publicly so that we have something more than just individual media stories, which a lot of times aren't even from your neck of the woods, for society to use, you know, to look at and evaluate their own police department.
I see. Okay. You explain things very crystal clear, and I believe that benefits our audience tremendously in understanding your point. So this is a win-win situation, and I hope our listeners are taking advantage of the fact that we have a police administrator, a high-ranking official in the policing profession, to take time from his busy day to come and share with us. I think this is a plus, and I think this is excellent information that goes a long way to building trust with the community, no matter where the community is. And the things you shared lead right into my next question. I've often heard the argument that consent decrees impact and injure officer morale. And you mentioned that a good jumping off point is to acknowledge that the exhibition of bias that was reported in the white paper that you authored, again entitled Seeing Color in Police Discretion, is also prevalent in other professions such as medicine and medical environments, education and teaching, home appraisals, just to name a few among the many others. So my question would be, how much of a criticism that law enforcement receives is brought upon by their own actions that qualified immunity paves the way for?
So there's a few things I could comment on that topic. I've done research on qualified immunity on my Lobotomy of the Law webpage, and it critiques the procedure that's used in applying qualified immunity, which you can read that in depth, you know, if that's something that interests you. But essentially what it gets at is that there's a two-step process. Number one is they determine whether or not there was a constitutional violation in that specific instance. And then the second step is determining if there was a constitutional violation, was that constitutional law clearly established with a specific enough case with a similar fact pattern to the extent that an officer or any reasonable officer would understand what they're doing violates the law. Where this is open for critique is relatively recently, 2009, I believe, is Pearson versus Callahan, off the top of my head, I believe, where the Supreme Court changed the procedure and said courts can skip to the second prong and only answer that question, which has the effect of them now creating no more precedent, and they keep pointing to the lack of precedent as the reason to give qualified immunity. So I have some critiques about the void that creates in case law, but I would have to do a different type of research altogether together to analyze whether or not qualified immunity should exist. So that said, just some off-the-cuff thoughts to your question is, so number one, immunity is a concept as old as the law itself. We have state immunity built into the 11th Amendment. We have sovereign immunity that goes back to common law era. We have absolute immunity for judges and prosecutors. And then we have qualified immunity for officers that came about, notably in the 60s. And it's immunity that's qualified. It's based on the qualification that of certain conditions. So it's not a blanket immunity. But to answer your question, I think, like, number one, there's got to be some room for good faith in this profession, just with the number of decisions that occur in the average day of a police officer. Now, do I think that cops are lax because of the existence of qualified immunity? Like, in other words, are police going about their encounters just saying, well, if I mess this up, it's no big deal because I'll get qualified immunity? I haven't experienced that at all in just my personal career. To be honest with you, I don't think that most officers really even know or understand what exactly qualified immunity is. I've experienced that the threat of being sued seems to be a fear mechanism that drives many officers and many administrators in the police profession. And that's something that we're all used to hearing all the time. And it's gotten to the point where officers cite potential liability as a concern, whether or not to do something before they even understand, you know, whether or not there is actual liability in what they're doing. So it seems to be a red flag that people throw up quickly. So your question would ultimately be a question of deterrence. Like, does the presence of qualified immunity serve as to kill any deterrence that officers may have to behave constitutionally? If you look at vicarious theory of deterrence, there's three factors. So number one is swiftness of punishment. Number two is certainty of punishment. And number three is severity of punishment. And a common understanding there is that severity of punishment is the least effective factor, with the swiftness of punishment being more effective. And the legal process of getting the qualified immunity can be extremely lengthy, and it's by no means pain-free for the officers involved. There's still a federal lawsuit that you're served with. There's still a lot of internal scrutiny by your department with the officer. There's depositions. There's court. There's a lot of things that sometimes happen in reaching that process. So it's not necessarily just an oh well, who cares moment. What's also interesting about officers, you know, the question of whether officers understand qualified immunity. Judge Michael Mills wrote in one of his denial of qualified immunity cases, he serves in the Northern District Court of Mississippi, and he was quoted in saying in his opinion that it's rather fictional to assume that police officers read federal appellate decisions at all. And similarly, Judge James Branning, U.S. District Court in New Mexico, stated that he did not believe that officers routinely read Supreme Court or appellate court opinions in their spare time, nor are they likely to approach a suspect and pause to themselves and say, hey, are the facts here anything like the facts in the case of York versus City of Las Cruces? So I do question how much officers know about it. I think where the question gets better and we get closer to an answer is Joanna Schwartz wrote a really good article called Police Indemnification as it relates to qualified immunity. And she made a really good point that when qualified immunity was developed, it assumed that the officers would be paying the damages if they did not receive qualified immunity. So in other words, it started off as a way to give that cushion that I talked about that you need for some amount of legal room and good faith in making rapid and important decisions. But at the same time, if you behaved in an incompetent manner, there was the fear that I will personally have to open my wallet as a police officer and pay this judgment. What's changed that is indemnification law. In most of the states that I've come across have indemnification laws, which is the police agency has a legal duty to indemnify, defend, and pay legal judgments against officers that occur within the course of their duties, even if they're ruled against. So what that has done, that has completely taken away the fear that, you know, I'm playing with someone else's money. So even if I am wrong, I'm not going to be the one paying it. Our city will pay it. Our city's insurance carrier will pay it. And I think that's had a much greater impact on whether or not there's deterrence as compared to qualified immunity. So I think that's the question ultimately at the end of the day is who's paying. And if it's not you, then you can imagine, you know, what the level of concern becomes.
Yeah. Perfect segue. My next question is, do you think officers care about the dollar amount the city pays out on use of force or misconduct cases?
So it's a question of finance, you know, on the officer level and even on the administrator level, is what is the understanding of finance? Because we'd have to first think about, do we see this as real money before we can ask, do we care about where the money goes? And man, I've seen police administrators in my own area that do not understand that their department plays with real money. They'll go back to the government officials and, you know, ask for more money than what was budgeted, you know, mid-budget, and they'll get denied. And they'll say things like, well, don't you think law enforcement's a different animal? You know, do we really have to stick to this budget? And that tells us that, like, these leaders, these police leaders don't understand, like, you're playing with real money. And when you run out, that there is a bottom, you know, to that bucket. It can run out. Now, of course, the city, you know, if it runs out, we'll find some way to fund public safety, but it ain't going to be a good way. You know, number one, hopefully they're getting rid of the irresponsible leadership that caused that problem, but then they can take out bonds and other stuff like that. But that's still harmful to the community because now they're having to borrow money and create money that didn't exist by way of debt and other things. So I think there's, number one, a big misunderstanding about whether or not public safety actually has finite funding, and it does. So once you reach that understanding, I think officers are more likely to care what happens to their agency's resources. And what I've tried to do in my own experience is explain to the officers that, you know, liability costs will directly affect how many, if any, new vehicles we get for our fleet next year. It'll directly affect whether or not you get a pay raise next year. It'll directly affect whether or not we can hire more officers to make your job easier, and so on. So I think when we start speaking and leading in those terms, officers are more apt to realize the consequence of their actions, which leads to them caring about whether or not there is, you know, a financial loss from misconduct.
Yeah, I think those terms that you mentioned would definitely make an officer's ears perk up as far as paying attention. I follow exactly what you're saying. Recently in the news, we just closed out the National Faith in Blue Weekend that promotes dialogue between faith-based organizations in the community and facilitates safer and stronger communities by engaging law enforcement officers and local residents through the connections of faith-based organizations. What is or what would be one aspect of Faith in Blue that you especially liked?
So coincidentally, we're looking at getting involved with something very similar to this, grouping up with faith leaders and their congregations and meeting, you know, in an outside setting and having conversations about what it is they want from the police department. And what led to this thought is, you know, in PR events, we've done a good job, I believe, in connecting with kids and having good moments with kids, but not so much at all with adults. And what this usually looks like on, you know, PR with children and the police, it's something where we set up a, you know, stand somewhere, or hand out candy, or play football, stuff like that. Those are certainly positive, enjoyable moments. But that progress can be lost extremely quick if that kid then goes home to where they're back in an environment where the parents don't trust the police. Their parents are going to have a whole lot more influence over them than we ever will. They spend so much more time with them than we ever will. So we're really giving up a lot of ground by not focusing on adults as much as we do children. And I think this is a great opportunity to do that. And what I like about these types of settings where we get in and we're willing to listen, that it's not taking advantage of the event to have a captive audience and try to educate the audience on why the police stop so many cars and why the police are searching cars and why the police are behaving this way and officer safety this and show me your hands and all this stuff. And instead, do the complete opposite and listen to your audience and find out what is it that they want from the police department? What is it that we can explain to them that meets those questions? And if we can't meet those questions, then we have to question what it is we're doing. If, you know, if we are serving anyone, you know, if we're making pretextual traffic stops disproportionately, one question to ask is who are we serving when we make a pretextual traffic stop? And if I don't have a good answer for that, a real actual answer, then we owe it to the community to discontinue that or change their tactics or listen to what it is they want. So I really like that type of environment. And it's definitely a grounding moment that gets you out of your echo chamber where you're used to talking to other police professionals who defend all the negative criticism that they get.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, to access more content from the Assistant Chief of Police, our special and honored guest here on this episode of Light 'Em Up, please visit www.lobotomyofthelaw.com. Again, that's www.lobotomyofthelaw.com. You know, criticisms of how police exercise their discretion are not new or uncommon. Police officers have the authority to arrest. Authority is power. Oftentimes, police exercise that power in complex and chaotic circumstances. Police officers use force against people for a number of reasons. For example, to detain, to arrest, self-defense, in the defense of others, in the defense of property, to prevent escape or injury, also to prevent destruction of evidence, and to quell riots, just to name a few instances. Although there are many reasons why police may utilize force, there is but one basic purpose: to gain control of a person and to stop any threatening action by that person. You know, any use of force upon a free citizen by a police officer is governed by the Fourth Amendment's objective reasonableness test, which focuses upon the severity of the crime at issue, whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officers and others, whether the suspect is actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade arrest by flight. These three considerations fall under the umbrella of the totality of the circumstances known to the police officer at the time force was utilized. The use of force and the discretion officers employ in doing so is a complex, multifaceted, and always an ever-fluid dilemma. You know, we've been very fortunate to sit and talk with the Assistant Chief of Police. Sir, for your time, talent, and expertise, we're so grateful to you. And, you know, we just want you to know, like we said before, you'll always have a forum here with Light 'Em Up, because you tell the truth. Like we say, the truth disturbs, the truth divides, but ultimately the truth delivers. And we just feel completely honored to have had an opportunity to sit and talk with you. And I think it's important to show gratitude to people who educate you or to help share wisdom. And you certainly educate and you share wisdom. You know, I just would like to offer the opportunity for you, our special and honored guest, to close us out with whatever's on your heart, whatever's on your mind about today's episode, or anything that you want to say. We want you to know that we're grateful to you, and we want you to know that we appreciate everything you've done and everything that you do for the community that you serve. And we just wanted to say thank you. So close us out.
Well, first of all, you know, thank you, Phil, for the opportunity for me to be here and to share my thoughts with your audience. And I think those were some very good points you made there, especially speaking about the phrase totality of circumstances, which is a pretty regular legal concept in police case law, Fourth Amendment type encounters. And I think that's a really good tie-in to really what we were talking about for this entire episode. Is the concept of totality of circumstances refers to the sum of all the parts of the situation weighing more than their individual pieces. So it's kind of like a 1+1=3 type situation. And that's kind of what we're missing when we look at topics of racial disparities and we just hyper-focus on the individual encounters and say, well, this one encounter was legal, this one encounter was legal, and this one was legal. But when we look at the totality of the circumstances, is there a disparity? And that's what we got to get to the bottom of. So we got to think bigger. We got to zoom out, and we really got to figure out, you know, what it is, what impact are we having on the world that we live in? And, you know, that's the direction I'd like to see more police administrators look towards.
Hey, I want to thank my friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting. Their fresh-squeezed hydrating green tea, loaded with amino acids and antioxidants, help replenish and neutralize skin for that natural glow. You want to know the best part? Their tea is organically grown and chosen for skincare from 3,301 Korean native green tea varieties. The winning 1-2-3 punch combination consists of the youth-enhancing serum with black tea. Then you just dap a little bit of the eye serum underneath your eyes. And finally, the enhancing cream. Oh my goodness. Like Muhammad Ali used to say, I'm pretty. I'm still pretty. They offer innovative beauty solutions for men, also powered by the finest natural ingredients, responsibly sourced from Korea's pristine Jeju Island. Their proprietary extraction methods preserve the purity and potency of these wholesome ingredients from plant to bottle to your skin, offering advanced formulas that safely address all skin concerns without the use of harmful chemicals and preservatives. With the wonders of nature at the heart of Innisfree, they take care to preserve and protect the environment in all that they do. We want to thank our friends at Innisfree for their promotional products and underwriting of Light 'Em Up. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to us on YouTube and Instagram at Rizzo's Protective Group. We're very excited about being ranked 10th out of the top 35 criminal justice podcasts as ranked and listed by FeedSpot. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to FeedSpot at www.feedspot.com. And please, por favor, per favore, visit our friends at https://newsly.me. Newsly is an audio app for iOS and Android. It picks up web articles about the most trending topics on the web at any given moment and reads them to you in a natural human voice. For the first time in the history of the internet, the entire web becomes listenable. You can browse articles from topics you choose and start playing. Hey, stop scrolling, start listening. You can follow any topic, as specific as you like, from sports, science, to Bitcoin. It'll find you the latest articles and read them to you. Hey, it's as easy as that. And to top it off, they have podcasts as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 50 countries. Our podcast, Light 'Em Up, is there too. I started using it as my default podcast app, and you can too. Download and use Newsly for free now from www.newsly.me or from the link in the podcast description liner notes and use the promo code Light 'Em Up. And Light 'Em Up in this case is spelled LGHTEMUP. All one word. That's L1GHTEMUP. All one word.